Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the presence of foreign militaries, including that of the US in the region, is the source of discord and damage. A massive document leak exposes hidden offshore assets worth the millions of dollars allegedly tied to over a dozen heads of state. Also in the headlines, 8 people are killed in India's Uttar Pradesh state amid farmers' continued protests against controversial agricultural reforms laws. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the presence of foreign forces in the region is a source of discord and damage. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has called on regional countries to provide their own security and prevent foreign interference in this regard. The leader made the comments in a ceremony held for graduates of military academies in Tehran.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has warned countries against the consequences of relying on foreign powers to guarantee their security. The leader was addressing a virtual ceremony held for graduates of military academies in the capital, Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei added that the presence of foreign forces in the region is a source of discord and damage. He said the armed forces of the regional countries can ensure the security of the region, and that they should prevent foreign interference in this regard. The leader also spoke about the US military presence in Afghanistan and its chaotic withdrawal from the country. A row between France and the US over a security pact in the Asia-Pacific was also among issues mentioned by Ayatollah Khamenei. Last month, the US and UK announced a deal to provide Australia with technology and means to build nuclear-powered submarines. As a result of the trilateral cooperation, a similar Franco-Australian deal worth $40 billion was scrapped. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian reacted with fury, calling the agreement a stab in the back. President Emmanuel Macron also urged Europeans to come out of what he called their naivety on the world stage and assert their independence from the United States. Iran's leader said such a spat shows that even European countries, which are not opposed to Washington, feel that there's a deficiency in achieving lasting security because of reliance on the US. America's allies are already looking on with concern at Washington's approach toward France and Afghanistan. The approach is seen as a warning to US allies in East Asia and West Asia and raises the need for them to have plans to cut dependence on the US and explore ways to ensure their own security.
Political commentator Sayyid Mustafa Khoshchesh says Western sanctions prompted Iran to develop its military capabilities for self-defense.
And they pushed Iran to develop its own arms program. And now Iran is a power in this region. And the CENTCOM commander says that they have lost superiority, air superiority in this region because of Iranian drones and because of Iranian air defense systems. Now Iran has grown self-reliant as an independent state, but it has developed its military prowess just for the sake of deterrence, because it has always been under threat by the United States and Israel, and it has never initiated any kind of war in the past 300 years. Therefore, it doesn't mean to impose hegemonic rule like the United States or Israel on others, but it means to defend itself. That's why Iran sends flotillas to different parts of the world, Navy groups, but just for exercises and to improve its offensive power. But it never deploys naval forces alongside the U.S. territory to pose threat. As a matter of fact, Iran's doctrine is based on deterrence in order to defuse the United States and Israeli threats.
Palestinian farmers have rallied outside the United Nations office in the besieged Gaza Strip, demanding an end to Israel's restrictions on the exports of their crops. The Palestinians say the restrictions are aimed at making them lose their livelihoods. We have more in this report from Gaza.
Palestinian farmers have held a rally outside the United Nations headquarters in Gaza City to condemn the Israeli ban on the export of their produce to the occupied West Bank and abroad. The Palestinians handed a letter to the representative of the United Nations, also protesting the obstacles and restrictions imposed by the Israeli regime on the international marketing of their crops.
The price of tomatoes is dropping and we are not making any profits. This is because there is no export to the West Bank or any other country. Palestinian farmers are living in hard conditions and have a limited source of income. The Israeli regime forces us to remove the tomatoes covers for exports, and this causes damage before they make it to the markets. We want the borders to open so that we can export our crops, and we demand imports of the required tools for farming.
Palestinian farmers say large quantities of their crops are piled up at Kerm Abu Salem, which is the only gateway out of the Gaza Strip, and are damaged. They say the Israeli regime has imposed impossible conditions on the exports. The Palestinians say they depend on the crops as their only source of income, adding that the regime seeks to destroy their livelihoods.
No crops are allowed to enter other markets. We demand an urgent opening of the borders so our crops can reach the West Bank in the same day they are exported, so the produce get there fresh.
This rally is held to protest the persistent Israeli restrictions on exports of Palestinian crops from Gaza to the West Bank. The impossible conditions that the Israeli regime imposed are aimed at damaging Palestinian crops and preventing the farmers from having a better income. This is a systematic policy to collapse the Palestinian economy and isolate it from the world. Farmers here call on the international community to stop these restrictions. The estimated daily loss for Palestinian farmers is very high.
The Israeli regime keeps imposing restrictions on Palestinian traders and farmers, keeping them from exporting their crops. Palestinian traders and farmers called on the international community to stop these restrictions that led to serious financial losses and dealt a blow to the Palestinian economy. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
A massive document leak has exposed the hidden offshore assets worth millions of dollars allegedly tied to over a dozen heads of state. The so-called Pandora Papers investigation, spearheaded by some 600 journalists, is based on nearly 12 million documents leaked from 14 financial services companies. The documents highlight Jordanian King Abdullah II's alleged property empire and corruption of Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev and his inner circle. The papers have also implicated the Czech Prime Minister, the Kenyan President, Pakistan's cabinet members, Ukrainian President, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, among other high-profile figures. The documents were reviewed by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. 8 people are killed in India's Uttar Pradesh state amid farmers' continued protests against controversial agricultural reforms laws. Farmers said a car allegedly owned by an Indian official ran over and killed 2 protesters in the Lihampur Kheri district. 6 others were killed in subsequent clashes, including 3 members of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. People in the state of Haryana held a demonstration in solidarity with the deceased farmers. Tens of thousands of farmers have been staging protests across the country against new agricultural reforms. They say the new laws will overturn a mechanism that sets a minimum guaranteed price for their crops. The government, however, argues that the new laws aim to make the agriculture sector more efficient. North Korea has restored cross-border communications with South Korea after dropping them in August. The news was announced by Seoul. North Korea also said its leader Kim Jong-un's intention of reopening cut-off communication lines between the two countries was to establish lasting peace on the Korean Peninsula. The two Koreas had signaled a surprise thaw in relations in late July by announcing the restoration of cross-border communications, which had been severed more than a year earlier. But the detente was short-lived as North Korea stopped answering calls just 2 weeks later, taking issue with joint U.S.-South Korean military drills. Now, Catalan protesters have marched through central Barcelona to mark the fourth anniversary of a referendum on independence from Spain. Around 1,000 demonstrators took part in the rally. They renewed demands for independence from Spain and asked the political leaders to join them. Catalans said yes to separation from Madrid in a referendum held on October 3rd, 2017. The Catalan parliament approved the vote, but it was declared unconstitutional by the federal government. Since then, tensions have remained high between Madrid and Barcelona. Last month, the two sides began talks to ease the tensions, but they say they remain far apart. Thousands of demonstrators have gathered in the UK's northwestern city of Manchester to protest against the ruling Conservative Party's annual conference there. The protesters, who described party leader Prime Minister Boris Johnson as a liar, have called on the party, held under heavy police presence, to leave the city at once. Saeed Poreza has sent us this report.
See a ring of steel and a little army of police, think the British Conservative Party, here in Manchester for their annual conference, with the party leader pitching his Building Back Better mantra yet again. Crashing the party, thousands of protesters from far and wide to tell the Prime Minister he and his clique are not welcome.
There's an array of groups and people who have gathered here today to demonstrate against the Conservative government pretty much everything it stands for, from its domestic policy to foreign policy, from its pandemic response and its position on migrants to its participation in foreign wars and its support for foreign occupation.
And they say examples of the government's failures aren't too difficult to find.
There's a gigantic economic catastrophe threatening the lives of ordinary people. There's a gigantic climate catastrophe threatening the whole planet. There is every reason why we can't trust a government of the rich, for the rich, to deal with these problems.
Another reason that's brought these demonstrators here, the controversial policing bill that gives UK police sweeping powers.
They don't need more powers. They need to be engaging with people in a protective way, not in a way where it's oppressive.
As a result of what critics call conservative government inaction, the UK has experienced one of the highest COVID death tolls in the world, massive economic downturn, a humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, hiking taxes, fuel disruptions, and a rise in Islamophobia and xenophobia in recent years.
I want to make it really clear to the Tories that they're not welcome in this city, that actually their position on fueling racism, targeting refugees, is absolutely disgusting, and therefore we want to make sure that they know just how angry we are.
A decade of Conservative rule in the UK has led to a groundswell of public dissatisfaction, which experts say will manifest itself in the 2024 general election. Saeed Poreza, Manchester.
Thousands have gathered in the British capital to mark Arba'een and pay homage to Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet of Islam. Many across the globe commemorate his martyrdom each year and remember his message. Our correspondent Bianca Rahimi was at the event and filed this report.
Tears were shed and prayers held in London's Marble Arch, bringing the sights and sounds of Karbala to thousands that gathered there from all over the UK. People from different backgrounds, but all with one thing in common, their love for the Prophet's grandson, who was martyred on the sands of Karbala in the year 680.
This is an extension of the world's largest peaceful procession. And despite the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of people have taken part this year to commemorate Imam Hussein and his family's sacrifice and evoke their message.
Imam Hussein and his family symbolize so many things for those that hold him in their hearts, hope for the oppressed being one of them.
This is the message of Karbala. He did it so that oppression and oppressors could be brought to light. And, people who are innocent, they have hope. So it's a message of hope as well, that you're not alone in this world. There are great personalities, there are people in the world who are ready to fight for you, to die for you.
What Imam Hussein's family went through after his martyrdom is also a focal point of Arbaeen, and the role the women played in the struggle.
We don't need to kind of look to secular role models to kind of take on wholesale this kind of Marxist feminism. We already have women within the family of the Holy Prophet, who had great strength and great dignity. And the important thing is knowledge. This is what we should be as women. We should be people of knowledge. That's the priority.
Every year, this procession highlights events that took place centuries ago, reminding humanity of the ongoing battle against tyranny that we all face today. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Iran has started inoculating its teenage population in a bid to reopen in-person school education. Iran's health minister made the announcement in a ceremony in Tehran that saw his grandson receiving the COVID jab himself. Yusuf Jalali reports.
12-year-old boy is the grandson of Iran's health minister, Bahram Einollahi. Mohammad Sadra received a Sinopharm shot with the presence of the health minister and local media outlets to encourage Iranian families to vaccinate their children with peace of mind.
I urge all families who have children between the ages of 12 and 18 to send their kids for vaccination. This way we can reopen in-person school classes safely in the upcoming months. I brought my grandson today to get the vaccine to prove that vaccines will bear no harm for children.
Iran has so far administered more than 58 doses of COVID vaccines. This means 68% of Iran's population has received at least one shot. This number was less than 10% around 2 months ago, when President Ebrahim Raisi took over power from his predecessor. Iran managed to accelerate the inoculation campaign by speeding up imports of foreign-made jabs, as well as supporting local vaccine developers.
Only in Tehran, more than 10 million people have been fully vaccinated. This is over 70% of the capital's population. The vaccination of lower ages will definitely help us get our kids back to school safely.
Based on the international health guidelines, minus 18 age groups should receive a single dose of COVID vaccine. The Iranian health minister said the country has taken the same approach and will administer one shot to its adolescents. He said once this phase is over, the health ministry will start vaccinating students between 7 and 12 years old.
While Iran lagged behind in the national inoculation program, it has managed to be among the first to inoculate its teenage population. If all goes as planned, children can go back to schools in less than 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thank you for staying tuned.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The latest U.S. drone strike that obliterated a family in Afghanistan was no mistake. It was a heinous crime, says Andrew Mitrovica, columnist, in an article published under the heading America's Litany of Lethal Lies. Stay tuned for more. By now, they have been forgotten by everyone but the people who admired, cared for, and loved them. Zimari Ahmadi, a father, brother, and son, was running his usual errands on August 29th. For years, the veteran aid worker had spent much of his time and energy delivering food and canisters of water to make the grinding hardship so many Afghans endure less taxing. That morning, like most days, Ahmadi, an electrical engineer by training, left the compound near Kabul airport where he lived with his four children, two brothers, and a slew of nieces and nephews. Ahmadi carpooled. So, driving a white Toyota Corolla, he picked up a few colleagues en route to the headquarters of Nutrition and Education International, the California-based humanitarian group, where they unloaded some bags and containers. At noon, he made a brief visit to a police station. Later that day, Ahmadi used the hose to fill several jugs with water to ferry home. He arrived a few minutes before 5 p.m. Then, in a happy family ritual, Ahmadi led one of his children, Hope, into the driver's seat to finish parking in the gated courtyard. A gaggle of excited children rushed to greet him and pack into the car. Meanwhile, a cousin helped unload the jugs of water. Within moments, a Hellfire missile fired from a Reaper drone obliterated the Corolla and anyone nearby. The 10 dead included Ahmadi and three of his children, Zamir 20, Faisal 16, and Farzad 13, as well as his cousin, Ahmad 30, and three of Ahmadi's nephews, Arvin 7, Benjamin 6, and Hayat 2, and 2 3-year-old girls, Malika and Sumaya. At first, the U.S. military insisted, with typical bravado, that its carefully planned attack triggered by unimpeachable intelligence that warned of impending mayhem was a righteous reply that read the role of a terrorist implicated in the murderous assault days earlier on Afghans and American troops milling outside Kabul's airport waiting for a flight out as far from Taliban's tentacles. It was the first of a litany of lies. The U.S. had not avenged the barbarity committed by terrorists. It had once again massacred innocents. Of course, after its lie had been exposed by the grieving family, other witnesses, and skeptical reporters, a U.S. troop was compelled to apologize for America's horrible mistake. And the cable TV personalities and their stable of serious-sounding pundits who had instantly applauded their country's righteous retaliation were now quick to agree that an errant missile launched by the U.S. military had dismembered and incinerated 10 Afghan girls, boys, and men in a tragic terror. That was a lie, too. The slaughter of Ahmadi and other Afghans in that tiny courtyard was not a mistake. Misspelling the word mistake is a mistake. What U.S. troops and spies conspired to do to Ahmadi and his extended family was a heinous crime. It was a crime that the U.S. military has, the incriminating record shows, committed often in Afghanistan and beyond. Only this time, America was forced grudgingly to acknowledge its guilt. A U.S. general said, "Clearly, our intelligence was wrong on this particular white Toyota Corolla. We thought this was a good lead. We were wrong." But U.S. troops and spies know that being wrong rarely results in being arrested. Just like all the other troops and spies who have made lethal mistake after lethal mistake in Afghanistan and beyond, none of the architects and perpetrators of this latest U.S.-engineered bloodbath will be held to account in or out of court. Instead, America may offer the surviving family members a vat of cash as a fleeting and meaningless act of penance to absolve itself of the responsibility for the horror it unleashed via an errant missile on still more Afghans trying to survive as best they can the deprivations, struggles, and indignities of war. On predictable cue, Congress, the military, and the intelligence community have promised to launch investigations and so-called lessons learned inquiries to try to find out what went wrong and prevent the carnage from happening again. Sure, they will. We need to understand exactly what went wrong and what that means in terms of the limits of what we are able to do, a U.S. congressman said. This is yet another feeble lie. U.S. politicians, troops, and spies have not learned, and will never learn, America's sordid, relentless history of killing civilians, many of them children, while waging its imperial wars is proof of that. Otherwise, America would have stopped making its calamitous catalog of horrible mistakes long before another Hellfire missile destroyed another Afghan family in late August. Here is the truth. The sprawling espionage industrial complex that set its technological crossers on Ahmadi and tracked his movements before deciding that he was a terrorist who had to be summarily executed is populated, for the most part, by plotting pedestrian bureaucrats. The spies also know they enjoy immunity from the inhuman consequences of their manifest archive of negligence and ineptness. Conclusion at after devoting years of studying and reporting on the secret subterranean world of spies is that the popular impression of intelligence agencies as housing dark people with impressive credentials dedicated with missionary zeal to protecting Americans from bad actors is largely a myth. It is, however, a stubborn, reassuring myth promoted by the television savvy former spies and their close friends in academia and a bevy of think tanks hired as consultants by agreeable U.S. news networks who invariably defend the interests and reputations of the powerful institutions they have faithfully worked for and within a variety of lucrative capacities. What the herd of cable news anointed experts are loath to share with their amenable hosts, let alone the network's fast-evaporating audiences, is that like any bureaucracy, the vast cobweb-like army of America's spies is infected by myopia, boredom, laziness, careerism, petty, corrosive jealousies, and an ingrained inertia that have resulted in intelligence debacle after intelligence debacle. Rather than finally address and confront this awkward but demonstrable fact, the experts traffic in the easy, palpable lie that the killing of Zimari Ahmadi and seven children was an understandable, albeit sad, mistake. When America's troops and spies commit their next atrocity, the experts will offer up the same flippant excuses, and the television host will nod in studied solemnity before moving on to the latest manufactured outrage like flitting butterflies. The rest of us would do well to remember how and why Zamir Faisal, Farzad Ahmad, Arvin, Benjamin, Hayat, Malika, Sumaya, and Zimari were annihilated, and the American troops and spies who, as always, got away with it.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the speeches and thoughts of the leader of Iran, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two Islamic experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasem Muhammadi and Brother Ali Alavian. Assalamu alaikum to both of you. So in the series of the program Viewpoints regarding the speeches of the leader of Iran, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, we are mainly concerned with the role that the human beings might have in this life and how Islam and a religious leader like Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei look at human being in different aspects and dimensions. Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the important concept of progress and development as tackled by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. You know, when we talk about progress and development in today's world, Sheikh Qasem Muhammadi, the first things that comes to our mind is these technical development and the industrial progress and development that we see in today's world. Regarding the Islamic point of view and what the leader mentioned, do we mean this exactly or not?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد وعجل فرجهم. So with respect to the meaning of development, the Islamic notion actually of development and progress, I believe that it exactly goes back to the foundations that we laid in other actually sessions that we had. So to understand this point in its true meaning, we should know the nature of human being, which is consists of two dimensions. First one is the worldly one, the physical one, and the other one the spiritual. And the God, actually the godly dimension of human beings. So what we actually observe in the countries that are not based on religion or true religions, what they take as development and progress is just in its worldly dimension. So the more that you are developed in your industry, you know, the way that people can make money, and other things, so that is actually considered by them as development. But does it matter that how the well-being, the spiritual well-being of the people is?
That's right.
It doesn't matter for them.
But some might say that this kind of development and progress might bring them a kind of welfare too. And this welfare might pave the ground for the welfare in the other world too. I mean, because the welfare of the human beings in general might be a kind of general contribution to the human race and human beings. What's your answer to that?
What I understand is not having money or not being that much wealthy as we have in our traditions is actually considered as a sort of impediment for a person's spirituality. But it doesn't work the other way around, I believe. You know, it doesn't mean that if you are wealthy, it paves the ground for you being a spiritual. This is not what we're seeing.
No,
actually.
Not wealthy, but welfare.
Welfare. So
the public welfare that these developments might brought, for example, in today's world see how
so
this...
How do you define welfare?
This technical development that we see around us so nowadays from our cell phones to the electricity and the lamps light here over here, you know, all of these things, you know, has paved the way for the human being in order to have a more facilitated way of life.
Yeah,
doesn't it help him to focus more on the other aspect of his own entity, that is the spiritual one?
The you know the evidence that we have actually accounts for the otherwise.
Okay.
You know, so what we see now in the industrial countries, the center of their actually focus and intention is now placed towards those examples of welfare that you mentioned. So it didn't help them in order for getting close and proximity to spirituality, but also actually it actually stopped them and halted them from getting there.
Okay.
So but I have to emphasize that I don't mean that we have to be poor or we have to lack welfare in order for getting a spirituality. I have to reiterate
yes.
what I said earlier, that yeah, for sure, not having or not being in a good shape as far as welfare is concerned, for sure is a sort of impediment for
right.
a person getting, sometimes at least,
okay.
getting close to spirituality. But on the other side, it doesn't work the other way around.
Also, some people think that inside the religious circles that anti-development, progress and science might help us very much in order to get richer, in terms of the spirituality, and get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I think this is a wrong interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Brother Ali Alavian, let's get to you, brother. So in the Western philosophy...
What's my take on that, let's say?
Yes, in the Western philosophy, we have with this materialistic progress and development. What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. I want to ask your permission to have a very brief introduction to this question. Then, inshallah, definitely I'll dive into it.
Okay.
Right after this brief introduction.
Yes, short as possible.
Yeah. Look, in our previous session, actually, we have started talking about the kind of difference that we have on our, let's say, humanism that we have in Islam and in the West, or let's say in humanistic schools. We said that the center of humanism in Islamic worldview is not the human itself. A human is valued, is expected, is respected, but the center is God.
That's right.
And in the other one, the center of the universe, that everything is at the service of human being. So this is a brief introduction to that. As for the progress and development, we can easily see and witness that the progress in the humanistic schools or humanistic look of it is something that actually just pays attention towards materialistic development.
That's all right.
And in Islam, there is actually a collection of both material and spiritual aspects.
That's right.
But very beautifully, you pinpointed an issue which needs to be actually discussed and scrutinized. That are we asked to just focus on the spiritual aspect and leave the material aspect? No. Islam wants the materialistic and material pleasures for human being to be at the service of human. And at the same time, spirituality is also looked as something which needs to be paid attention to. So we have understood that there are two dimensions which are looked at. Progress in its materialistic look is not what Islam wants it specific only. It is only one aspect of it. We need both sides to be collected to each other to actually pave the way for the human being to go towards perfection. In those schools, the more profit you make, the more prosperous, the
uh-huh.
more progress, and the more developed you are.
Okay.
But in Islamic worldview, the more profit you make is not necessarily something for you to be more prosperous.
I know, this aspect is clear. But the case is that when we talk about technical materialistic developments, we
mm-hmm.
can see the touchable, tangible, results and
yeah.
the fruits.
Yeah.
But when we talk about development in terms of the spirituality,
mm-hmm.
what do we mean exactly?
Look, when we are talking about these developments, We actually, in the sense of the development itself, we are, I think, we have the same idea that they have towards it, like public welfare that you mentioned. But what is important in the Islamic worldview is that how is it distributed? Is it distributed among all the individuals in a society, or again, it is for a certain group of people? Social justice is very important in as a result of these developments and progress. The progress or development which lacks a good distribution among different classes and, let's say, all the individuals in a society is not what Islam is looking for. Islam actually respects the rights of all the people and all the civilians, all the members of the society. But in the other one, when we are talking about more profit to whom? To a certain group of people, layers of the society.
Okay. Thank you much, Ali Alviana. Sheikh Qasem Mohammadi. So in this way, the human being, when he's put away from being center of the world, and God, the Almighty, is the center, and I mean this theocracy, is ruling over the world, then the meaning of the development and progress might change. And in terms of the religious frameworks that we are living in the Muslim lands, we could see that the people are trying all their best in order to reach Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, my question is this. Doesn't it have any shortcoming, I mean, this kind of belief system? Because we want to limit the progress and development to reach Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but at the same time, the means that we are using are materialistic. I mean, through materialistic ways and materialistic means, we want to reach to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and we want to meet the final goal, which is the spiritual development. Isn't this a type of contradiction?
How do you understand that as a contradiction?
For example, in today's world, just look at it this way. There is a final cause of, for example, doing a religious act or action. Mm-hmm. And we are doing all of them through the developments that have been made by the Western world we are criticizing.
Yeah.
Actually, is it true to say that we are looking for the final cause and the means are not important for us, whether they are developed and invented by the Western world or not?
Actually, I may understand.
I think this is an ontological question for you.
Yeah, but okay. Actually, I don't understand, you know, the way that the today's world is working, the way that you are actually portrayed it. By no means, you know, having those, you know, means of welfare make us close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or make a better settings for us getting approximate to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Actually, as I mentioned at the beginning of this show, sometimes, you know, there are, or many times, they may sort of play, you know, the role of an impediment to getting close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So the thing is that, you know, Islam and religion, the true religion, divine religion, doesn't say that, you know, you just have to focus on your, you know, your spirituality, and you have to forget about, you know, your physical desires or mundane, this worldly desires. This is for sure is not what Islam says or any other true religion would say.
Okay.
But okay. Can we make use of other, you know, the developments in order for getting pleasure for this world? That is also affirmed and confirmed by Islam. But what is not allowed by Islam is that, you know, to misuse, you know, development and progressing in order for just focusing on the worldly desires of human beings. So again, when we refer to this philosophy of Islam, that there should be God in the center. And if you want to put a human being in the center, it's okay, as long as it's defined within the, you know, within the monotheistic understanding of God.
Doesn't it mislead us from getting to the final cause, that is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
If you know,
I mean that now the causes become different and various around us, so sometimes we misunderstood the final cause. We are doing it for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but the final goal that we are prescribing for ourselves, we are recognizing for ourselves, is not God. It is the very means that we are looking for and very means we are working with.
Yeah, for sure we have to be, you know, always we have to be vigilant about these problems that may go around, you know, getting close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, including this sort of impediment.
That's right.
That just being busy and preoccupied by the means that are supposed to mm-hmm. to make you closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For sure that yes. could be a sort of consequence. But this is what actually what is mentioned in the in our holy scriptures as ghafla, negligence. So
okay.
So you have to be careful all the times, and you have to be mindful of these problems that may happen for you on the right path and on the path to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But it doesn't mean that you have to just forget about these things, because they may make some problems for you or may impede you from getting close to Allah, while they may actually be a sort of means for you or a sort of help and supporter for you to get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Okay, so still, brother Ali Al-Abiyan, we can progress and we can develop, but we can consider Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in all the aspects and dimensions of our development. Here, theocracy in the true sense of the word, if one rules over the world, well, the people has to get back into their fitrah, but we are busy so much with our surroundings in today's world, especially in the 21st century. You see how the media is working on the minds of the people. The people sometimes are forgetting themselves, let alone to think about the God inside themselves. So this is what the human beings are busy with in today's world. Sheikh Qasim Mohammadi and Ali Al-Abiyan, thank you much for your presence in the program Viewpoints.
Thanks to you.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us on Arab English Radio. This is Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en. Also, visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page called Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you. Fi amanillah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong. A world that often lies, cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
There are so many untold stories about Haiti. We need to begin with the United States' refusal to recognize Haiti after its independence in 1804. Most people do not know the story of the U.S. occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934, or that of the resistance movement led mainly by the peasant group known as Les Cacas, as well as by students and intellectuals, which forced the U.S. to end the occupation. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Cecily, a Sicilian writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Media Have Distorted Narratives on Haiti Since 1804. It's still happening. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. There are so many untold stories about Haiti. We need to begin with the United States' refusal to recognize Haiti after its independence in 1804. For over 60 years, while the U.S. was still a slave-owning nation, Haiti, as the world's first free black republic, was ignored and punished. That early refusal to recognize Haiti's independence was a failure to acknowledge the humanity of Haitians, and a failure to acknowledge the humanity of enslaved people within the United States as well. Responsible reporting about Haiti needs to start here, with that lack of humanity. Most people do not know the story of the U.S. occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934, or that of the resistance movement, led mainly by the peasant group known as Les Cacas, as well as by students and intellectuals, which forced the United States to end the occupation. But the damage to Haiti's constitution was already done. Haiti has been referred to as the Republic of NGOs because of the large number of non-governmental organizations or NGOs working in Haiti. The majority of these NGOs contribute directly and indirectly to weakening the Haitian state by focusing on the interests of the country and organizations that they represent and not working with grassroots organizations to have a real impact. The deep corruption of the Haitian government is connected with the 2% of Haitians with foreign passports who own Haiti and are constantly capitalizing on the ongoing disasters, both human-made and natural, so they can maintain their privilege. These 2% who work behind the scenes in what we usually refer to as a politique de doubleur, or supported by the superpowers, U.S., Canada, France, the United Nations, etc. For instance, during elections, the elite usually work with these superpowers to ensure that their chosen candidates become president so that they can better control Haiti. Let us not forget the neoliberal economic policies that contribute to food insecurity and prevent food sovereignty, forcing peasants to leave their lands and move to urban areas in search of a better life, but instead enter a cycle of worse poverty. There is the complicated story of rural livestock in Haiti that were slaughtered and destroyed in 1980s by the U.S. to prevent the spread of African swine fever into the United States. The livestock represented a savings bank for the farmers, but the indigenous livestock were replaced with imported animals that were ill-adapted to the tropical climate. The wholesale death of rural livestock subsequently dismantled the livelihood of countless numbers of farmers. This impacted the Haitian economy so much that there was a direct impact on children's education, since farmers were not able to send their kids to school because they couldn't afford tuition and uniforms. In 2010, former President Bill Clinton apologized for the trade policies that destroyed the livelihood of rice farmers in Haiti while enriching Arkansas farmers. The apologies did not help. People continue to starve and have to look for other alternatives. Some Haitian migrants must take treacherous routes from Brazil and Chile to Mexico. While crossing borders, there are economic advantages for these countries because these migrants have to pay for food and accommodation, and the flights from Port-au-Prince to Chile and Brazil contribute to these countries' economies. There is the old myth stemming from colonization that dictates that black bodies are inferior. Let us be clear and honest. If the Haitians were lighter skinned, would they have been given the same treatment? Probably not. The current treatment of Haitians at the border and the use of whips and horses is inhumane. Do those who think it's acceptable to treat Haitians this way see them differently because of their black bodies? Many Haitians are hard workers. There is currently a labor shortage in the United States. What if we could get past the narratives and the images and think that perhaps, just perhaps, some of these Haitian migrants could possibly be able to contribute to the workforce? What if we could identify skill sets that they may have and provide language and acclimatization training so they can contribute these skills for the greater good? In 10, 20, 25, or 100 years, we wonder what a story we will tell of Haiti. Haiti's ongoing climate crisis started during the period of colonization with the French exploiting its natural resources. It continues today in the forms of deforestation, earthquakes, and hurricanes, both man-made disasters and disasters resulting from capitalism, neoliberalism, inequity, and greed. All these are contributing factors that push people to migrate. Perhaps then, the United States will be open to really seeing the Haitian migrants with dignity, compassion, care, empathy, and humanity.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.